This is Cyril Pidge Palmer, interviewed by Chris Eldon Lee on the 1st of February 2013. Pidge Palmer, Part 2. Pidge, I was sent a document written by Peter Hooper, who died quite recently, about heading south the year you went to the Antarctic, to Anvers Island. And for the first 3 weeks of the voyage, Pidge Palmer and Lofty Tyson ran the hotel on the ship. What does he mean by that? Helping in the galley and servicing meals. It was comparatively hard work, serving and clearing up the meals and giving the whole mess and bunk area a thorough cleaning every morning, including scrubbing the floors and organising Porky. What do you remember about him?
Porky, yeah, the little mess boy. Nice little lad. Shouldn't have been at sea.
Why not?
He wasn't fitted for it, really.
This is on the Biscoe going down, isn't it?
Yeah.
You had some 3 days off the boat in Montevideo. I think you should start confessing now, don't you? What did you get up to?
A lot.
What can you tell me?
Well, we got a whole... We went to a hotel, quite a posh hotel. We used to have a wander around during the day, and then we found a particular bar, club type place in the evening, and mostly university students there, and we became very friendly with some of them. In fact, the girl I met came to see us off on the when we sailed, and even sent me records and wrote to me down south about what was going to happen to us, the two of us, after I came back from the Antarctic. But of course I didn't. It was not possible to keep in communication with her. It's rather disappointing for her, I imagine, because she seemed rather keen on me.
You think she fell in love, do you?
I think so, yeah.
Were you communicating in English or Spanish or both?
English, Spanish, a bit of Spanish.
And you couldn't maintain the communication from the Antarctic? That was a problem?
Well, one of the problems, yeah, but I really wasn't interested anyway.
Settling down, eh? Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's interesting. Did you manage to communicate at all from Deception or with her?
No.
So it was all one-way traffic?
Yeah. Which I wasn't happy about, but then, you know, I didn't intend to do anything about it anyway, so there wasn't much point in continuing.
You could have sent the letter, I suppose, by boat sometime, could you?
Oh, yeah. Mm.
But you best not. Mm. At the end of your first year at Deception, I presume you signed for 2 years, had you? Mm. Did you know where you were going to be second year?
No.
So what...
I can't remember when... Well, they obviously told me where I was going, but I can't remember the occasion.
You were, in fact, going to set up a new base?
Yeah.
On the Danco coast at Danco Island? Mm. And you were not asked to be base leader?
No. Foster.
Yeah.
Who was made base leader because he was... I imagine for the construction of the hut, really. He was a surveyor-type builder fella.
Right, so you think that he was given the job because it was more appropriate for his skills?
I think so. Maybe they thought, well, he's not been too good at the last one, so Didn't bother me.
It didn't worry you? Really? No. Do you know why they decided to open a base at Denko Island?
No. Just to survey that area and geologise the area.
But there was a problem, wasn't there, with its location?
Finding a base site became difficult, and that's why we went on this small island instead of the mainland. Yeah, it was difficult to get onto the mainland.
My understanding of the process was that it was a captain of the ship that chose the base site.
Yeah.
And obviously he was thinking, well, what was he thinking? He was thinking about access from the sea, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Or was he overlooking something else?
There was never any discussion with us about the site, which is a bit disappointing. We're a couple of miles off the mainland, and we only had a small dinghy, of course, which made it rather difficult. And to get from the shoreline onto the... It was a climb, you know.
On the mainland, you mean?
Yeah.
You could get across to the mainland, but then you had to get a route to the plateau.
Yeah.
I think you made several attempts, didn't you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What do you remember of that?
It was good. I enjoyed it.
Were you in any of the trips to try and find a route?
Yeah, yeah.
We were?
We did manhauling, of course. You could never have... If they'd had dogs, it would have been impossible, I think, to get them onto the mainland. You know, it wouldn't have been feasible at all.
Do you remember a particular trip where you tried to get up to the plateau and couldn't?
No, not really. I remember we stopped on one occasion, on one trip, for a brew and a smoke, and I, standing by the side of the sledge, and went down into a hole. So we moved quickly from that particular spot.
Was this a snow bridge that collapsed?
Yeah, and Fred Wooden and... I don't know who he was with, fell down a crevasse, you know. And they spent the night there and eventually got out the next day using the sledge as a ladder. They didn't fall down too far, and then onto a bridge. Yeah, that was when you needed to be able to talk, and the only way we communicated was clicking in the handset.
So he was clicking down a crevasse, was he?
Yeah.
Were you on the surface or back at base?
I was back at base, yeah.
So tell me a bit more about that. Were they just the two of them out alone?
Yes. I can't remember who he was with. Might have been Ginger Kettley.
Hmm.
The other surveyor, assistant surveyor.
That would make sense, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
So what happened? How did you discover that the problem had arisen?
Well, we had a schedule, radio schedule. You know, at certain times.
And did it happen?
Yeah, on the schedule, you know, we'd come in... Fred or whatever, and just a click. So then we started questioning them. But they got out.
Was there a rescue party?
No, they got out the following day, morning, and came on down to the landing space.
And when you went down, was that a long way down or just up?
Oh, no, I was only up to my
waist.
So
that was a little warning.
Yeah.
To get off. There's a photograph of the hut here at Danko. Did you build that?
Did what?
Did you build the hut?
We built the hut, yeah, but that's not the hut. That was our little bivouac while we were building.
Oh, right.
There was a packing cases and a tarpaulin over the top.
This is the temporary accommodation?
Yeah, oh, yeah. Mm. I could show you some of the building, you know, the building work.
Well, tell me about it. Tell me about the process of building this hut.
It was very interesting.
Cool. Really.
And you probably know that all the building was made by Bolt and Paul in Lancashire somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
The builders of the aircraft builders as well. And the hut was built, every piece was marked and then dismantled and then sent down to us. It worked out very well, I thought. You know, the pieces came together and we didn't have any problems. Making the site level was one of the things. You know, building the concrete pillars for the hut to stand on.
Was this right by the shore or higher up? Yeah.
No, it's very close to the shore. In fact, they dropped us off and said, we'll be back in X weeks to help you build the hut. And in fact, the day the Shackleton came back, we put the last nail in the roof and hoisted the flag on the flagpole. So they didn't have to help us at all.
It was that efficient?
Yeah.
And excellent timing from the captain's point of view.
Yeah. Yeah.
Had you done that kind of thing before in your life?
No. And Les, the carpenter, he, excellent fellow. Les Harris.
Yeah.
He was a real down-to-earth scouser, a bit rough, right? But lovely fellow and really knew his job.
So he was kind of foreman, was he? He was... Yeah, dishing out.
Oh yeah, he knew what was happening. And of course, Foster. What's his first name?
Dick.
Dick. Yeah. Was also obviously very knowledgeable, but Les was the main driving force on that.
Yeah, Dick Foster. He lives in Lancashire now.
Does he?
Yeah, I saw him in the summer. Yeah, interviewing him. Describe the hut then to me. What was it like?
What, when it was finished, you mean?
Yeah.
Very comfortable. We had a... I can show you all the photographs if you wish.
Well, just describe it in words.
There was the entrance... with a bunker for the fuel, a passageway, on then the bunk room on the right, and an office further down. We had room in the loft for all the stores, and my radio room, which was hardly ever used, of course. Very comfortable. We even had curtains. Gingham curtains.
Insulated?
Yes, yeah. Oh, much much better than the Deception Hut, obviously. But yes, it was it was good. Double glazed windows. A stove in the bunk room. And we had plenty of fuel, fortunately. Except... when we needed to,
all the bags were frozen together, so it was a mining job when you wanted to get extra fuel.
But of course, as you mentioned earlier, the generators failed. So it was quite dark at times in there.
Yeah.
And that meant you couldn't make many radio broadcasts.
Right.
So how were you filling your time if your main purpose, the radio man's job, was so truncated?
Well, we were improving the hut all the time, of course. And
what sort of refinements?
Preparing for the next trip out.
What sort of refinements to the hut were you making?
Well, I built an imitation television set.
I beg your pardon. You have to elaborate on that, Cyril.
No, it was just a wood box with a screen and a picture I put on the screen.
Did people watch it? So how much surveying actually got done then, would you say?
A fair amount of that. There wasn't any geology work done. In fact, what was his name, the geologist?
Geologist Bailey. Geologist was called Bailey.
Yeah, what was his first name?
I'm afraid I don't... M.B.
Mike, was it? No, it wasn't Mike Bailey. Oh, dear. He was annoyed because he never found any fossils.
Brian.
Brian Bailey, yeah. We were out on a boating trip, he and I, looking for specimens. And I was the only one that found one. And it wasn't any use anyway because it was on the beach and so it wasn't in situ. So it was no use. He didn't know where it was from or anything. But he never found any other.
And because you were not sending MET results back because there was no weathermen on base, that then the radio job was a lot smaller.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was non-existent, really. I was just another member of the group.
Yeah.
Waste of time. Waste of my qualifications.
Well, I was going to say, how did you feel about your time in the Antarctic? Because it does sound like you were less than fulfilled by what you were being asked to do.
Oh, no, I don't think so.
No?
No.
Well, how do you feel about your 2 years south?
Oh, great. I really enjoyed it. Yeah.
And do you think you achieved much? Or was it just a good experience?
I suppose only during the second year, you know, at Danco, having established the base and done some survey work. Yeah.
But you were already aware that the base really was in the wrong place, weren't you?
Aware it was what?
But were you already aware that the base eventually would be deemed to be in the wrong place?
Oh, yeah.
And that limited the work you could do?
Yeah.
Because of the poor access onto the mainland?
Yes.
Yeah. What else do you remember about that Danco year? Were there any close calls, apart from your...
No. Oh, well, when we're out sledging, yeah. We were doing one trip, the four of us, when we were relaying stores and stuff. And the weather was fine. So we got from one dump, we were going up to the other to make a camp, right? And when we were at our new campsite, the weather came down. No, that's not true. We made a camp, put the tents up, and then sledged down, skied down to the stores dump. And when we got there and was setting off back to the base camp, to the campsite, the weather came down, and a blizzard, and we didn't know where we were.
Mm.
So we dug a hole,
mm.
and we stayed in it for the night, managing to keep awake. And when the storm, the blizzard went through, we were initially, we tried, you know, on keeping contact with each other by ropes and that, to fan out and try and find our camp. We knew we weren't far from it, and when the blizzard went through, we were about 50 yards from the tents, fortunately.
When you dig a snow hole like that, do you then try and cover yourself with something, or do you leave yourself open to the sky?
We hadn't anything to cover ourselves with, or the hole. Yeah.
So you were just basically building a depression to get into, rather like the trenches in the in the war.
Yeah.
Hoping that the worst, it would fly over your heads.
Yeah, that's right. And apparently, I don't know who said it, but you hadn't to go to sleep, you know, or else that was it. You'd freeze to death, probably. So we had to keep awake all night, which we managed. I don't know how, but we did.
Were you fearful?
I suppose you always think, oh, well, we might get out of this, hopefully.
Was there any time in the Antarctic when you did really fear for your life, when you thought you might be a goner?
No. No.
How about funny incidents? What made you laugh out loud?
Can't think of anything.
When your time came towards the end of your second year and you started contemplating coming home again, how were you feeling? Were you glad to leave by then?
No, no, not glad at all, no.
Sad to go.
Bit sorry, in fact.
Yeah. So what had happened then in those 2 years to make you feel reluctant to come home?
Well, I enjoyed the whole time there. And you didn't know what I was coming back to anyway.
Well, Teddy Boys and Bill Haley.
Yeah.
I'll come to that in a minute. So had you fallen in love with the place then?
I think so, yeah. Danko, yeah. Not Deception.
And what was it you were falling in love with?
No idea.
The landscape?
Yeah, the fact that you were there with and not many other people had the privilege to be there as well.
Was Danko particularly beautiful?
Yeah, I think so.
Can you explain?
That's the
view
from the top of our island.
It's a particularly spectacular landscape, isn't it?
Yeah.
You've got a panorama photograph, one of those ones where several pictures are placed in a run together.
Now, I don't know if you want to record the next bit.
Well, you tell me.
Go on.
You see these two peaks? Yeah.
There.
In the distance?
Yeah.
There's a girl in Stanley in the office called Una. And we name those Una's tits.
I don't think it ever got on the map.
So who was Una?
Una, she was a girl in the office in Stanley.
Was she well endowed?
Probably. I don't think. I know Fred put them down as on his survey as that, but I don't think the Antarctic Place Names Committee passed it.
They are known universally amongst FIDs as Una's Tits. On the map, they're Una's Peaks.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So Una is immortalised.
Oh.
I believe. I'm sure I've seen this.
Yeah.
She's immortalised, but her bosom is not. What more can you tell me about Una? Was she fun?
I don't know. I never met the...
Oh,
the
When you came out of the Antarctic, how did you get back on the Shackleton?
Yes. But the new governor was... when we came out, the new governor was coming to the Falkland Islands. So we were having to stay a month in Port Stanley. When the Biscoe went up to Montevideo to pick up the governor, I went up on it. I asked permission to go up on it and stay in Montevideo till the Biscoe came back again, which I did. So I had a month in Monte.
Did you meet the Senorita again?
No. Someone gave me the name of a girl in Stanley who was a nurse in Montevideo. Contacted her, and she showed me around, and we went to a... She said, "I'm going out to an Englishman who runs a cattle farm or something just outside Montevideo. Would you like to go?" And I went with her, and there was a girl, she was of Russian descent, and she was the loans manager for the Bank of Canada. And she and I became quite friendly. And I had quite a good month in Monte.
Why did you have to hang around? Why did you have to go back to Stanley to meet Arrowsmith, I think it was, wasn't it? Who was coming to take over?
I don't know. We were all a bit annoyed, really. We'd finished. Why we couldn't go straight home? And then we had to hang around I was fortunate and had the month in Monte.
But you had to go back to meet Arrowsmith?
No.
You didn't?
No. I waited. I picked the Monte, the Biscot when she came back to Montevideo.
But do you know why the other FIDs were made to wait for him? Was this etiquette?
No, because they needed... no, I came home on the Shackleton, didn't I? That's right. I waited for the Shackleton to come back. They weren't able to travel back to the UK until the new fellow was installed.
Because they were catching the ship that brought him?
Right, yeah.
I see. What happened when he got back to the UK? It was a very interesting time, the late 50s. There were lots of changes happening, weren't there?
Yes.
Did you notice differences?
Oh, yes, yeah.
Such as?
I don't know, really. No, I can't think of anything offhand.
Some people say it was just everything had speeded up.
And
did you feel that? You were back in 56, what, 57?
57.
Mm. What happened to Pidge Palmer after that? What was your next adventure?
I contacted an old friend, Ted Van Dort, who was a Marine RO in the same company as me when I was at sea. And he said he was taking his flight RO's license at Hamble, air service training at Hamble. And why didn't I do the same, start flying? So I took the course in Hamble, got my license, and I wanted to join Aquila Airways with flying boats out of Southampton, which was part of the Silver City Britavia group. And I was on the waiting list for a vacancy, and one of the chaps I was on my radio course with, a South African, got the job ahead. He was ahead of me, one ahead of me. Vacancy came up for an RO with Aquila. He joined it. He joined them. And a couple of months later, they had a crash on the Isle of Wight. After takeoff. And after that, the company, the flying boat service
ceased,
folded up. Mm. In the meantime, the personnel chap said, while you're waiting for a vacancy in Aquila, would you like to go out to Libya on the DC-3s that are working for the oil companies?
And you were piloting these planes?
No, I was still an RO.
Radio operator?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I went out to Libya for 3 years. Then there were, at the same time, John Ryder, another RO, and myself bought a Tiger Moth and had it shipped out to Libya, because we were, ROs were being phased out in that stage because of the advance in communications, single sideband and so. And so that we were going for our pilot's licenses. And I'd already got a private pilot's license anyway. So then they wanted to get rid of the... There were six of us ROs in the in Libya, and I was chief RO at the time. And so they made the others redundant and kept me on in case of any special trips. And then the company I'd been freelancing with, Morton Air Services at Croydon Airport, when I got my license initially, said they were short of someone to go out to Chittagong. Would I consider coming back and joining, you know, on a permanent basis instead of freelance? Which I did, because we were flying doves and herons in that company, and it meant that I could log any empty leg as pilot time, right? So I joined Morton Air Services again, went out to Chittagong for 14 months. And we also had contracts in Karachi for Sui Gas and Rangoon for Burma Oil. So I, you know, spent time in Karachi and Rangoon as well. But my long term was in Chittagong.
How long were you there for?
14 months.
Okay.
That was good. Yeah. That's when met Jim Greenshield, the ex-Canso pilot at on the aerial survey.
And did you stay in the aviation business then for your professional life?
Yeah, I after Morton's, we became part of British United Airways. And the I myself and another chap were asked to go to ask if we wanted to do the pilot's course up in Perth. So we went up there for our checks and we were both accepted. And the course in those days for a commercial pilot's license was £3,000, right?
Yeah.
And which they said we would take out of your pay, you know, which was fine. But at the same time, Air Congo, or Sabena Afrique as it was then, were looking for ROs in the Congo. And the money was really, really good. And had just been married. And to pay £3,000 back was going to be very difficult and newly married. So I opted for the Congo. And as I say, eventually my wife said, you come home or we come to the Congo, which is when I joined Laker Airways on the ground. And I was op superintendent when we went bust.
What do you recall of that period when Freddie Laker went under? Was it a shock?
It was a shock, yeah. I used to take my children to school in Lingfield. And I used to get probably into operations about 9 o'clock in the morning. But when you left, was another, you know, could be 24 hours later. But I went into the ops room and looked at the board and I said, why hasn't the New York gone yet? And Alan Millership, who was the duty officer at the time, said, we've gone bust. So I said, Alan, don't mess about. Why hasn't the New York gone yet? He said, we've gone bust. And I thought, he mean it. And that was it. That's how we found out.
Do you know why? Because he was right, wasn't he? The SkyTrain paved the way for everything that's happened since.
That's right. But all the national airlines ganged up on us. And, you know, there were, all kinds of things that happened. It was really bad. We kept going for a while. Douglas wanted us to keep going because we had quite a large... we were hurting the other airlines because we had, you know, the DC-10s by then. And... We were making a lot of taking a lot of traffic from them, but it happened. Then we got an American backer came in and wanted to start Laker Airways as British Atlantic with the same crews, same aircraft. And go for the Falkland Island contract, all right? So that was okay. And then he pulled out for some reason, and was when Branson got involved. So Branson said, I don't want DC-10s, I want 747s, I don't want the Falkland Islands, I want the States. So that meant all the crews and aircraft that was going to be British Atlantic couldn't be used anymore. And I was going to be ops manager. And so Alan Hillary, who was the chief pilot, and Jeff, who was the chief training captain, couldn't be chief training. Because to train crews from DC-10s to 747s, very expensive, even on a simulator.
Right.
So the when everything fell through for British Atlantic, Alan Hillary gave Jeff... gave what was going to be my job as ops manager. So that was it. I got my old seagoing licences out and went to work offshore on a drilling rig.
Oh, really? Gosh, where was that?
In the North Sea.
Aberdeen?
Yeah, off Aberdeen, yeah.
Mm. Is that where you wound up your working life?
Yeah, unfortunately, an American company, Penrod Drilling, their retiring age was 60. And when I got to 60, I said to the ops manager, look, I don't want to leave, I'm okay. He said, as long as you can pass your medicals and offshore survival, you can stay as long as you like, right? Then he retired, and our rig manager, who hated Englishmen, took over, and I got home one trip and there was a letter saying you've got to retire. And he'd been on the rig, on my rig, the day before, or 2 days before, and he hadn't the guts to say it's a... So I got to 69 before they made me retire.
You were 69 years old and working on an oil rig.
Yeah.
Pidge, that's pretty good going.
Yeah. I thought of taking them to European court, but whatever. But
so you retired at that point, did you?
I had to.
Yeah. Looking back over an amazing career and lifetime, how highly does the Antarctic rate, those 2 years south, rate in your life?
They all rate the same. Maybe I've always enjoyed what I've been doing, the various five separate careers. but I think maybe the Antarctic was slightly above the rest. Yeah. Yeah.
It's been great fun, Pidge. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.